Dr. Michio Kaku is a theoretical physicist and host of the science channel Sci-Fi Science Physics of the Impossible. He's also author of a book, Physics of the Impossible, and his new book, Physics of the Future. I talked to him at length about his latest book and a little bit of this and that. Now, one of the first things I wanted to ask you, I was a little curious, and I do want to touch on your books and everything too, but I was curious, you're a self-admitted sci-fi fan. So did the fan come before the physicist, or was it vice versa?
About the same time. When I was 8 years old, two events happened which changed my life. The first was that Albert Einstein died. Everyone was talking about the fact that he couldn't finish his greatest work, the unified field theory.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So I said to myself, I want to work on the unified field theory. The second thing that happened was I got hooked on the Flash Gordon series on television.
Okay.
I used to watch that show every Saturday morning. And I was hooked.
I mean,
ray guns, flying rocket ships, cities in the sky, invisibility shields. And then later in life, I began to realize that they really are, in some sense, the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
If you understand physics, you understand the outline of the future. You understand what's possible, what's not possible, what's plausible. And that's the key. The key for me to understand the future was to become a physicist.
Gotcha. Okay. That's an interesting choice of careers at that early of an age.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
So you went on, you became a physicist, you've done a lot of great work. Now, you have written several books, the latest of which is the new Physics of the Future. And this was kind of fun, because I just returned from a sci-fi convention, and in that convention we did a panel that was about how technology and science fiction has sort of prophesized and brought to life a lot of things that we use in our everyday life now.
Mm-hmm.
And this book is very much about a lot of the technology and stuff that's just being developed now that's going to affect our lives in the future. So it ends up being a kind of nice bookend for me.
That's right. In fact, I've had the privilege of interviewing over 300 of the world's top scientists who are inventing the future in their laboratory.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not a science fiction writer. I'm a physicist.
Right.
And my colleagues are also physicists, chemists, biologists, and inventors. And they tell me the outline of what's going to be happening 10, 20, 50, 100 years into the future. For example, even in science fiction, we sometimes hear reference to the fact that the Internet is going to be in our contact lens.
Mm-hmm.
You'll simply blink and you'll be online. These contact lenses will recognize people's faces, print out their biography in your lens as you talk to them, and translate from Chinese or German into English with subtitles as you talk to them. We're going to have them, perhaps in 10 to 15 years.
Yeah.
So we already have scientists working on prototypes of the Internet contact lens. And the first people to line up to buy these things will be college students taking final examinations.
Google some answers.
Yeah, that's right. The second people to line up to buy these Internet contact lenses will be artists, architects. They'll wave their hands, and they'll be able to create all sorts of gorgeous sculptures, buildings, all sorts of different kinds of things, just by waving their hands.
Mm-hmm.
The military is also dumping millions of dollars perfecting this thing. They want an Internet of the battlefield so that a soldier will simply blink and see the entire battlefield laid out. Enemy forces, friendly forces, artillery, aircraft, everything laid out on the battlefield. The tourist industry is very much interested in these things. Already in China, in Beijing, you can see the animation of the Summer Palace, which was destroyed during the Opium War,
mm-hmm.
resurrected. They've already done this with animation. You can now put that, in the future, into your contact lens. So in the future, tourists will walk through the streets of Beijing or Rome and see the entire Roman Empire or the Chinese Empire resurrected inside their contact lens.
And never leaving the comfort of the living room.
That's right. So these are coming very quickly, very soon.
Very interesting. I could definitely see where in something like where you mentioned like architecture and engineers, where anytime there was any question about, well, what do the plans say, they could literally just blink, like you said, blink and pop up the plans without having to find the right one and have lots of paper laying around, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, and if you're a Star Trek fan, this mm-hmm. is a huge step for the holodeck or the Matrix. You'll be able to recreate entire imaginary worlds inside your contact lens just by running a motion picture and be able to conjure all sorts of different kinds of fantasy environments. So So this is a huge step toward creating a fantasy world as well as the real world. This is called augmented reality, by the way.
Okay.
Quite a few scientists are working on it right now. I took a film crew to Tokyo, in fact, and interviewed one scientist who uses augmented reality as X-ray vision. The military, for example, knows that when a fighter pilot is in a dogfight and the enemy plane goes underneath your plane, you are dead meat.
Right,
however,
can't see him.
If you put a camera underneath your airplane, shoot the image of the camera into your contact lens, you will then have X-ray vision. You'll be able to see right through your feet, right through the fuselage of your aircraft, to see the location of the enemy aircraft. So you see that the military is taking this very seriously.
Yeah, absolutely. Very interesting. You know, on the and related with the internet, there was something in your in the book that I thought was pretty interesting. Was the idea of the future of computers, and that even the word computer would sort of fade from existence, you know, out of our language.
Right. Think of the word electricity. No one says the word electricity anymore.
Mm-hmm.
We simply assume that the electricity is under our feet, in the walls, in the ceiling. Electricity is everywhere and nowhere. And that's the future of computing. Computing will be done in the cloud. We will meter it, just like we meter water,
Right.
like we meter electricity today. And we will assume that computing power is everywhere and nowhere. For example, in the future, you'll talk to the wall, because wallpaper will be intelligent in the future.
Mm-hmm.
We can make paper intelligent. These are called organic light-emitting diodes, or plastic computers. And these plastic transistors can be made into a fabric that you just put on your wall.
Right.
So in the future, you talk to the wall, and you can conjure up any scene, any screen, any kind of piece of information just by talking to the wall.
Right. You know, I think it's kind of interesting. It's almost happening already when you think about it. I mean, when was the last time you heard anyone really say their computer? Typically, it's their smartphone, their iPad, their e-readers, and all of which are computers, but we certainly don't never call them that. They're not our music computer, you know.
Right. And if you go even farther into the future, by mid-century, we'll simply access computers by thinking about it, by
mm-hmm.
mentally
mm-hmm.
thinking and then accessing power supplies and accessing computers. One of my favorite episodes of Star Trek was when the crew of the Enterprise meets the Greek god Apollo.
Right.
Who does seem to be Apollo, but they figure out that he really is a mortal who accesses a power supply using his mind, and then his mind controls the computer. That gives him the power of a god.
Mm-hmm.
That's how we will live, perhaps in the year 2100. We will be like the Greek gods. We will simply think, access a power source in our house, which has a computer in it, and it carries out our wishes, just like in Star Trek. And just like Venus, who had a perfect body and a timeless body, we too will have a perfect body. That's the end point of medicine now.
Mm-hmm.
Not just to cure diseases, but to have perfect bodies. And we'll also extend the human lifespan. And like Apollo, we'll have chariots that ride in the sky. We will have flying cars, finally.
Finally.
And Pegasus is, of course, this mythical animal that doesn't exist. We will be able to create animals that don't exist on the planet Earth anymore. We'll have zoos of extinct animals, for example.
Mm-hmm.
Already, we've sequenced the genome of the Neanderthal, and there's some talk about, you know, bringing back the Neanderthal. And there's also talk about bringing back the mammoth.
Right,
these
yeah.
are definitely all within the realm of biology.
Yeah, when they talking about the medicine, leading right into you were talking about nanotechnology would really be kind of on the forefront of medical knowledge in the year 2100. Would literally have little robots inside our bloodstreams that could zap anything that would ail us before we'd even know it was there.
Right, and we even have a version of that right now. These are called nanoparticles. They home in on cancer cells,
mm-hmm.
and they kill them cell by cell. We will look at chemotherapy like we look at leeches and bloodletting today. And these nanoparticles already exist. For example, a normal cell has holes, pores on its surface that are quite small and quite regular. Cancer cells have large, raggedy holes in their surface.
Right.
You can now design a molecule that'll fit right between the two. It's too big to fit into the hole of normal cell.
Mm-hmm.
It fits right into the large raggedy hole of a cancer cell, killing it in the process. So So with 90% efficiency, we've been able to kill certain tumor cells. So the word tumor will also probably disappear from the English language. We'll no longer say the word tumor.
I'd welcome that. I think that'd be fantastic.
And our first line against defense, by the way, before cancer forms a tumor, is your toilet. Every time you use your toilet, there'll be a DNA chip in your toilet with
Okay. Some
proteins emitted from cancer colonies of maybe 100 cancer cells 10 years before a tumor forms.
So you'd be getting sort of a medical checkup every time you use the restroom.
That's right. And again, this already exists. DNA scans already exist.
Right.
Boston Medical wants to, in fact, commercialize it in about 3 years' time. The system there in Boston can pick out one cancerous cell in a billion normal cells.
Jeez.
So this is going to revolutionize the way we view cancer. Like, for example, Steve Jobs, the founder of Apple Computer,
mm-hmm.
has pancreatic cancer, which is usually fatal. In the future, we will zap pancreatic cancer when it's a colony, even before it forms a tumor.
Yep, amazing. A lot of this, if in the future we do need surgery of any kind, if the little nanobots can't do it or whatever, there's certainly talk. And then again, like you keep saying, this is even happening now, where there'll be robots to do a lot of the dirty work or the finer work that humans can't do.
That's right. We even have a robot system called Da Vinci. It's already commercial. It looks like a gigantic spider.
Mm-hmm.
And when you put on a helmet, you can guide each of these arms of this spider with incredible accuracy. For example, open-heart surgery usually requires you to crack open the front of your chest.
Right.
Horrible process, cutting up your rib cage and leaving hundreds of different kinds of stitches everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
In the future, with the Da Vinci, you can go in from the side and create micro holes, tiny little holes you can barely see from the side, in order to perform surgery. And so we're witnessing a revolution. And in Star Trek, we have the tricorder,
right,
which some people think cannot exist because it can do everything, like look inside your body and diagnose illnesses. We will have the tricorder. The MRI machine today, for example, is about the size of a room.
Right.
The smallest MRI machine that is possible is the size of a briefcase. But the people in Germany who built this briefcase-sized MRI machine predict that the smallest you can make an MRI machine is the size of your cell phone. Well, that's a tricorder.
Yeah, exactly.
And so in the future, we'll have the tricorder just like Bones in Star Trek uses the tricorder.
That'd be amazing. Now, what about, you're talking about the human-controlled, robot surgical tools or whatever. Will we ever see the robots that are essentially self-sufficient and, could do this sort of stuff on their own?
Well, one area that is not progressing as fast as we would like is artificial intelligence.
Mm-hmm.
Even though the IBM Watson computer beat two people on the program Jeopardy,
right,
answering questions that even humans couldn't answer correctly, the robot was so stupid that it didn't even know that it won. It was totally unaware of the fact that it just won the contest. Because these are adding machines.
Right.
We forget that no matter how sophisticated they are basically super fast adding machines. They're one-trick ponies.
Mm-hmm.
Now, our brain is not an adding machine. Our brain is not a computer. There's no software. There's no Pentium chip. There's no CPU. There's no Windows. Our brain is not a computer. Our brain is a neural network. It's a learning machine. It simply rewires itself after learning every task.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why our brain can do these fantastic feats that ordinary digital computers cannot. So we have a long ways to go. However, that said, maybe by the end of this century, we'll start to have computers that are as smart as a monkey, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
At that point, they could become dangerous because they'll be stronger than us, faster
right.
than us. And some people fear that one day they'll put us in a zoo, throw peanuts at us, and make us dance behind bars. So what I did was I interviewed the top people in artificial intelligence theory. And the New York Times also did this. There was in a conference in Asilomar
mm-hmm.
2 years ago where all the top people went. And the New York Times asked them, do you believe in something called the singularity, when robots surpass us in intelligence and take over? And the results were quite interesting. The range of opinion was some people thought that in 20 years, the robots will take over. Other people thought that maybe in 1,000 years, the robots will finally become smarter than us.
Right.
So there's no unanimity even within the field of artificial intelligence. But when I interviewed these people, I found there were three groups, three different attitudes toward the singularity.
Mm-hmm.
One group says that we should let them take over. They are our children. We created them. They are our successors. They're going to be smarter than us, stronger than us, reproduce faster than us. So why not let them take over? That's one group that says that we should gracefully bow out and let our evolutionary successor dominate the earth.
Okay.
That's one group. The second group says, over my dead body, I'm going to get a shotgun. I'm going to take on those damn robots and blow them apart. No one's going to be smarter than me. And these people believe in putting a chip in the brain of these computers to shut them off if they start to revolt.
Mm.
And these people want to recruit Harrison Ford to hunt down these
robots. I was going to say, this sounds very Blade Runner-esque.
Right. That's one group of people I interviewed.
Mm-hmm.
There's also a third group. The third group I interviewed said that we should merge with these machines because why not wake up one day with a perfect body? Why not wake up one day super strong, super intelligent, immortal?
Mm-hmm.
It sure beats waking up with aches and pains and looking forward to death one day.
Popping
right?
knees, yes.
Right. So there is that group that says, why not? Why not let them merge with us so we benefit from them? And, you know, there is something to be said for that. We are beginning to unravel the aging process.
Right.
So even without mechanical implants, we might be able to extend the human lifespan in the coming decades. Our grandchildren, for example, may have the benefit of living to the age of 30
mm-hmm.
and then simply stopping and cruising at the age of 30 for several decades. So this is well within the cards of science.
Well, I'll be jealous of them, I'll tell you that. Okay. Now, let me ask you something. This, doing all your research for this book and the your previous book, which was, Physics of the Impossible.
Impossible.
Yes,
right.
Thank you. And then, of course, you've got the television program based on that, the sci-fi science, Physics of the
right.
Impossible.
Right.
What you've done, your research for some of this stuff was... Did you come across anything when you started looking into it that even you were surprised that you found out that it was like it was feasible?
Well, look at the space elevator. The idea of having Jack and the Beanstalk
mm-hmm.
climb a beanstalk into heaven, that idea is pretty old. About 100 years ago, the Russian physicist Konstantin Tsiolkovsky actually did the calculation and showed that the beanstalk would snap if you were to create such a space elevator into the sky.
Right.
So the idea for that languished for about 100 years until the last few decades when scientists invented carbon nanotubes and
right.
Carbon nanosheets called graphene.
Mm-hmm.
Graphene is the strongest substance known to science. It is much stronger than diamonds, also made out of carbon. It's one molecule thick, like saran wrap made out of carbon. It is so strong that you can take an elephant, put the elephant on a pencil, and balance the pencil on this saran wrap of carbon, and it will not break. That's how tough it is.
That's strong, yeah.
That's strong. So with graphene and carbon nanotubes, it's now conceivable that we might be able to build a gateway to heaven. So you go into an elevator, and you push the up button, and it takes you all the way into outer space.
Right.
That would really drop the cost of space travel.
Yeah.
To the point where the average person would be able to go into outer space.
Yeah, okay. That's a heck of an elevator ride, though.
Yeah.
Not one you want to get stuck on.
No, you don't want to get stuck on that one.
No. Well, okay,
but it
sir.
It would reduce the cost of space travel quite a bit. You know, it costs $10,000 to put a pound of anything into orbit around
right.
the Earth.
Right. Mm-hmm.
That's your weight in gold. That's the price of gold.
Mm-hmm.
So imagine your body made out of solid gold. That's what it costs to put you into outer space, just orbiting the Earth. To put you on the Moon is about $100,000 a pound. To put you on Mars is about $1 million a pound. That's the cost of diamonds.
Wow. So
imagine your body made out of solid diamonds. That's what it costs to put you on Mars. So we've got to reduce the cost.
Right,
that's
so something
expensive.
So something like a space elevator, if we could just get at least that first step out of the way to get you to space, it would dramatically reduce the costs of then going out further.
Right.
If you could take all the materials and everything up that.
Yeah, the first step to heaven is just the first 100 miles.
Mm-hmm.
So once you're outside the gravitational pull of the Earth, then you coast. You basically coast your way to Pluto. So that's the stumbling block right now.
Right.
So we have to have a new way of getting into outer space because it's simply too expensive to build starships and dream about these things. So that's why we need something new. And that's where the space elevator comes in. And nanotechnology could be the key to the space elevator.
Yeah, nanotechnology could be the key to a lot of things. Just reading in your book, you were talking about nanotechnology that you could have little robots that could be programmed to be any number of things at the click of a button and change from one thing to another.
Yeah, this is called shape-shifting,
mm-hmm.
or something that is called programmable matter. We can program software, of course, but
sure.
You can also program hardware, that is, matter. I had a demonstration of this. I took a film crew to Pittsburgh, where at Carnegie Mellon, they actually have a team of scientists working on shape-shifting. Here's how it works. You take a chip, and you make it as small as you can.
Right.
The smallest chip is about the size of a head of a pin. And then on the surface of that head of a pin, you put different electrical charges. So these tiny little dots glued together in a certain formation.
Mm-hmm.
So if you push a button in one way, these tiny little dots form a sheet of paper.
Mm-hmm.
You push another button, and the charges rearrange, and all of a sudden it forms a cup. You push it again, it forms something else different. It forms a computer. It forms a table. It forms a desk. Pretty much anything you want,
right.
Given the fact that you can control the way in which these dots arrange themselves, just like atoms arrange themselves to create everything in our universe. So we're not there yet, but I had a demonstration of this.
Mm-hmm.
That is little blocks that can rearrange themselves on command. So that's shape-shifting.
Yeah.
One of these days, when we perfect it, we'll be able to create a city in the desert simply by pushing a button and seeing the whole city resurrect itself out of sand. That's the future.
That is the future. So out of all this stuff, some of the stuff that's in this book and your previous book, is there anything that you think we'll see maybe first, earlier, before the rest?
We'll see certain things pretty quick. We'll see the internet contact lens. We'll see
mm-hmm.
the driverless car. We'll see three-dimensional television without glasses. We'll see intelligent paper, intelligent wallpaper within the next 10 to 15 years.
Okay.
Beyond that, other technologies come into play, like invisibility. We'll be able to make objects invisible, just like in Harry Potter's movie series. We'll be able to have an invisibility cloak. That's a little bit further down the line, maybe 20, 30 years into the future. So hold on to your hats.
Yeah.
And then by mid-century, we'll have the power of a god. We'll be able to think and be able to move objects, just like in Star Trek. Think and be able to rearrange the molecular form of objects and almost be like sorcerers and magicians, being able to change one object into another.
Well, I am, for one, am looking forward to any or all. Well, Doctor, I want to thank you very much for talking with me today.
Okay.
It was a pleasure.
Okay.
All right. Thank you. All right. Bye. Physics of the Future, How Science Will Shape Human Destiny in Our Daily Lives by the Year 2100 is on the bookshelves now, and you can check your local listings over on the Science Channel for Sci-Fi Science.